Was it strange to be with Englishmen?
No, dear. No, to me, no. I really don't. For example, you know, I have now over in Coventry, England. I have two nephews, my brother's two sons, and his daughter, three there. In London, I have my sister's two daughters, and her son-in-law was married to her, and then I have another boy that belong, the oldest boy belonged to my brothers. So my other nephew, who is living with my sister now, with my sister, he's the oldest boy. He's 50, probably going up 58 or something like that. But he never got married, you know, he didn't want to get married. But he was over in England for 3 years and a half. And he told me one time, he said, I'd rather work for an English boss than for an Irish boss. You know, he got along with them fine. You know, I mean, as far as the English, I mean, the English, there is a lot of, in politics and, you know, and they're misjudge themselves. The common English people, you know, it's nice. And my niece now, for example, who's in London, and she takes care of a house, a very out, this big businessman, and he gives her the key, and she's the one that's taking care of it for years, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were always nice to her, you know, and her husband.
But putting yourself back in the way you were when you set out for America, the only Englishmen you really knew were the,
yes,
were the black and tans.
Yes, yes, yes.
So these,
yeah,
were the first.
Yes, yes, dear, and you know, the that's the black and tans, and of course, I mean, the prejudice, the bigotry, you know, the thing that was emphasized for us, like, in Ireland, it's the bad side, you know, for the English. Well, the poor English people themselves, like Henry, like myself, they didn't have nothing to say about it. Mm-hmm. IRA over in Dublin, in Belfast Island, now you hear sometime, and at Paisley, they are two groups, Protestant, and I don't know, I think the IRA, they're supposed to be Catholic, but I think a lot of them are communists. Some of them, they went over to, what's his name there, he's a radical in the East there, you know. I cannot think of his name at present. They were trained revolutionaries over there, you know, trained, you know.
Oh,
with the
mercenaries?
You know, with bombing and stuff like that, how to bomb. Gaddafi. Oh, mm-hmm. Some of them, they said, went over there and was trained by Gaddafi there. Well, of course, I mean, dear, my religion, my Catholic faith, dear, our Lord taught us, love your enemies, do good to them that hate you, pray for them that persecute you. And, you know, he said, he that kills a man, you know, when Christ was arrested at the Garden of Gethsemane, as St. Peter got a sword and knocked the ear off one of the high priests, so the soldiers of the high priest, and he healed him, and he told Peter, put out your sword, thou wilt fight for the sword, shall perish with the sword. So I say, we are taught, if we are living to it, but unfortunately, like the Jews, they didn't live up to their faith themselves, and Catholics, very often, they don't live up to their responsibility either. They, you know, I mean, we are not supposed to hate anybody. I don't care whether it's a Muslim or for their religion, you know, but our Lord said, do good to them that hate you. He said, you know, do good to all men. That's religion. That's really Christian religion, not an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. Mm-hmm. So that's why I don't believe. I believe, for example, I would like to see Ireland free and all that. But the objective is bad. I condemn, you know, I mean. Mm-hmm. If you can't get it free without firing a gun or killing somebody, you know, the IRA now in Belfast, they killed a lot of innocent Protestants, you know. They had nothing to do with it. And it only aggravates the thing. It only makes it worse.
Did you think in that religious way when you were 20?
Oh, I did, dear.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I did. I would thank God. I never want to hurt anybody. I that's one thing I did. I joined, you know, because 1917, I think, after the after the revolution in Dublin. That's when they started in Dublin. And our school teachers joined us. You know, we got joined, you know. And we used to march on a Sunday, prayed around somebody to, but there was no soldier there. Now, I wouldn't say we didn't get no real training. I mean, but anyways, it was kind of a unity like. And because of that unity, I'd be killed in the draft only for that, I think. I mean, killed over in the France in 19. I had three brothers older than myself, and I was 16. And in 1916, the four of us got our draft papers from the war office in London. They were going to draft all the Irish and send them. And all you'd get that time is 3 months training, and they were shipped you out to the trenches. And of course, I mean, they got slaughtered out there. You know, thousands of the Irish got killed fighting for the British. But I think on account of the uprising in 1916 in Dublin, and there was voting, I remember, 1918, they voted. I remember I voted. And they voted against the draft that they would not fight for the British. And I think that saved them, because they figured if they'd have to slaughter an awful lot of them, you know, they wouldn't fight. So I think that's what saved us from going there, dear. I had three brothers older than myself, and I was the fourth one. I was 16, going on 16 at the time, and I got my paper. Well, if the four of us, my father had nobody left, but my sister, she was about, that time, she was about 8 or 9 years. And my other brother, Thomas, he was about 2 years younger than I was, 15, 14. That's all my father would have. Oh. So, I mean, you can see that here, how unfair that was. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I remember in 1917, before this country went to war, there was a paper printing over that time that the war would last about 2 months at that time that Germany was winning. Well, that's the time that Germany invented the hand grenades. They were did an awful lot of slaughter with the hand grenades before the British picked it up, you know, some of them that did not explode, and they experimented on it, and they made their own bombs, you know, their own hand grenades. But Germany was the first one that used it. But I remember distinctly in 19 that period. Yes. Yeah.
Well, when you were coming on the ship, on the Celtic, was there a steerage class? Were there a group of people on the ship who were down in the bottom, in the hold of the ship?
No.
It would be lower than third class. It would be called steerage class.
Oh, no, I never heard that here. Uh-huh. Well, I think we were what you call the poorest class, and we were called second uh-huh. class, you know. But no, there was no, there was we had, as I told you, we were on the second sitting, as they call it, the second sitting, at breakfast, dinner, supper, I guess. And I would say, you know, the crew and every other, there was no bigotry, you know. I never remark that any of them insulted, you know. They were very polite, all I can say, very polite here. You know, Celtic was a beautiful ship, you know. I wish, if I would have known, I wish I had a picture of it that time. I would shellish it, you know. It's a picture of they had beautiful ships, you know, the White Star Line, you know.
Yes.
There was the Cunard Line, the White Star Line.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember the ship coming into New York Harbor?
I do, dear. Oh, I do, and I remember seeing the Statue of Liberty, you know. And we came into New York Harbor, I think. If I remember correctly, it was Saturday night, and we had to wait there until Sunday and Monday morning, because Saturday night, Sunday and Monday, as Monday, they took us off, you know, to go to Ellis Island, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what happened when you approached the Statue of Liberty?
Oh, yeah, we were happy. Oh, sure. And one of the astonishing things that I never forgot that astonished me, you know, and because, for example, I was brought up in the country, and you out in the country, maybe out in this country too, when there is no lights, you know, a dark night, you can hardly see the road there, pitch dark. But that's where I was brought up, in a country place. But one of the astonishing things I saw that stayed on my mind is the glare of lights along Long Island, you know, Long Island, New York there. Oh, out in the harbor, you could see there were beautiful sights. And then we used to get the Lipton tea. I remember my mother used to buy Lipton tea over there. And I saw this big sign flashing on and on, Lipton's tea and coffee, like that. And I got a, you know, it took me some years. I think it was 1925. I had my uncle of mine on my mother's side living in Hoboken, New Jersey. And I went to visit him, and there was, you know, a few blocks away where the big sign was. It was still going on, that was Lipton's tea and coffee. But I mean, I felt home. I never regretted coming to America. You know, I liked it always, enjoyed myself. And the good Lord was good to me. I always had good health, you know. I had a few accidents. I fell from a school window one time back in my 24 years ago. And I broke, you know, my wrist and I guess pelvis, you know. But I was 2 months in the hospital. But outside of that, my health was very good, you know.
Well, tell me about Ellis Island. How did you experience Ellis Island?
Well, I cannot be honest with you, dear. I cannot say much about it because, as I said, we were conscious of our, I will call it, inferiority complex. We had a lot to learn, and we, you know, to cope with the new system and a gun, and I didn't. All we were interested is to go in and test it and be passed and get out. But I mean, I didn't take no interest in looking around that Ellis Island. I couldn't give you any description of it. I know.
And did someone meet you there?
No, dear. No. Nobody met me until I came to the Union Station back here.
Oh, okay.
You know, there was a Union Station back here, and they got rid of it here about 20-odd years ago. But it was a beautiful station. My uncle met me when I got off of the train there.
Well, after you came from Ellis Island, then where did you get the train?
The train, when we got off of Ellis Island, they put us on a boat. And this boat brought us to South Boston, to South Station in Boston. Them days they used to have, I don't know if they have it today, but they used to have a boat coming from New York. Mm. And we got off at South Station. And myself and this friend of mine, my friend who was died many years ago, they put us on a horse and buggy, and he drove us to the North Station. And that's where we, and the lady at the North Station gave us a ticket, put it on our train, and we were all set, and we came here to Portland. My uncle met me, and his sister met this fellow that was with me.
I see. Did any one of the 40 people that you came with on the boat, were any of them turned back?
No, the only one I heard at Ellis Island is the one that was calling the dances, you know what I mean? He was well dressed up. But I heard, but I not definitely, I heard it that he didn't pass. I don't know, was it TB or was it disease or something like that. Mm-hmm. But he was a very nice, dressed up fellow, you know, smart, you know. I know what happened. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how many of them, I couldn't tell you how many, because we had no way of knowing who passed and who didn't pass, you know.
Well, did many of them come to Portland? They came with you on the boat?
No, there was the only two we came to Portland, myself and this Martin Flaherty. Uh-huh. That's the only two that came to Portland that time. Most of them came to Boston, some of them New York, you know.
Well, when your uncle met you, what was your uncle's name?
Mark and Cannon. He was my father's brother, you know.
Uh-huh. Now, what were your first day or two like here in Portland?
Oh, Gary, I remember he brought me down there. It's a store down there, Porteous Mitchell. And of course, in them days, they used to sell, because the longshoremen down here, they used to have a lot of ships there. There was 1,200 in the longshore, and 70% of those that was in the longshore were from Galway, you know. They were Irishmen from Galway. So it was common. Everybody had a pair of overalls them days and a jumper, you know. And that's the first place he brought me down to Porteous a couple of days afterwards to buy me a set of overalls and my jumper, you know. And the next thing I noticed around where the Shaw is now, there was a store there. And I saw these red apples. I thought they were painted, you know, first. Because, in Ireland, you see the apples, but they're green. Even for their right, they're green. But I never saw anything like that, like so beautiful. And of course, they were they were built up on a big, you know, laid out an advertisement. It was so attractive, so beautiful. Yes, that's one of the things. So I got acquainted with some of the fellas that came from my place. We worked together on the railroad there. And
you got a job right away?
Oh, yeah, I had a job, you know. The first thing, I think I was only here, I went to work for John and Romano. They was an Italian contractor at that time. They were the one that built the South Portland High School, but it's not a high school anymore. It's a junior high school, I guess they call it now. But at Fort William, they were building some, I don't know what kind of a big sheds that time, because Fort William's out here in my time, they were the soldiers used to come there. You know, there was a regiment of soldiers. There was another place out in the ocean near Fort Preble. They used to have soldiers there. They used to have a lot of soldiers. That's why that a number of the Irish girls ended up marrying some, you know, that's marrying them, you know. Mm-hmm. Because they used to work, you know, in the summertime, the Yanks, that we used to call them the Yang, the rich people back in the Western Prom. And they used to have mostly all domestic Irish girls working for them. And the summertime, they'd move out to the Cape there, you know, the summer resort. And the girls, of course, them there, they used to have the electric cars, you know, open. I don't know if you ever saw any of them.
No.
Wide open, you know, electric car. They were nice, you know. In the summertime, they were open, you know. And those soldiers, I guess, would be coming in. And that's how some of them got acquainted with them, you know. They got ended up marrying them.
Was there a large Irish community here in Portland?
I would say this, that church there now, dear, you know, across from over here, that was practically, you know, but good 5,000 people living there. They were practically all Irish, you know, all Irish longshoremen and their offspring and so on. In the meantime, their offspring, like I say, they got married and went moved out. And the automobile revolution took place. And so they moved out to Scarborough, you know, out the country way. You know, it was constant. A lot of the Irish, when they came here, of course, they were always concentrated in the town, like Boston, New York, Chicago, and Portland. They didn't. But, for example, in my case, I never had a car in my life. I had no occasion to have a car because I always walked a job, you know, the job I had worked. It's only a matter of whatever job. I used to work in the wintertime on longshore and... Then after the Second World War, I took a job as a fireman up at the Mercy Hospital here, across that you see here. Mm-hmm. I was there for maybe 10 years or 11 years. Mm-hmm. But I left because I couldn't adjust myself to the night shift very much, you know.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you were a longshoreman?
I was a longshoreman, I would say, for about 7 years. Uh-huh. I was a longshoreman for 7 years. We work in the summertime, work outdoors for a water company and, you know, for a contractor sometime. And in the wintertime, because them days, down the Grand Trunk here, down the Grand Trunk, there used to be 8 wharves there. And you could get two big ships on each wharf, you know. There used to be 16 ships there one time. Most of them all came from England, you know. We used to grain, sow them with grain and box meat. They used to come from Canada. Most of the goods that was loaded was from Canada, from Toronto and those places. And we worked there, you know, and the wintertime was good, you know. I remember 1922, I worked about maybe 40 hours one week on a grain that, and I remember I made $60. Well, that $60 them days was a good money, you know, mm-hmm. because the average wages was about 25 anyways. You know, even those who worked uptown, you know, had a good executive jobs there. Very few of them probably wasn't getting any more than that. But I mean, we made, you know, longshoremen in the wintertime, even though it's a lot of loafing. I never would like to do it as my living, but during a period there, you know, when I was working on the railroad and I got laid off in November, My uncle had me a giant longshore, so that's how I happened.
So first you worked on the railroad, then you went to the longshore?
Yeah.
And then after that?
Then in the summertime, I was here in 1925, and the summertime I used to probably work for the water company, because along the longshore down the Grand Trunk here, all the business that they, because it was all Canadian business, and they used to bring it down to St. John's, New Brunswick, because the ice was gone. The reason they used to have it, the reason we used to get so much of the Canadian stuff here is because the harbor was frozen down in Montreal there. They couldn't handle it in the wintertime. But in the summertime, all the business went down to Montreal, you know.
I see.
So we went to working for contractors or somebody like that, you know, each according to whatever your taste was, you know what I mean?
So when did you meet your wife?
Oh, I met my wife in 19 June, and I think it's in 1930. I met my wife in 1930. I was working up in New York, you know, after I came from Notre Dame, and I was working up in the Erie Railroad in New York, and I was making $27 a week, but I wasn't feeling good. I wasn't feeling good, and I told my uncle up there that I'd like to, you know, to. I was there was a man there living at that time, Brother Andre in Montreal, that he was a great cure man, and his reputation was high. So I wanted to visit him, and my uncle told me, "Why don't you stop over?" He said, "On your way and see your two uncles here in Portland. I had two uncles here," and I visited. And then my cousin, who was doing domestic work too, she was shimming around with my wife. Like, there were two young girls doing domestic work back in the Western Prom there. And she found out I was living out to Uncle, and she called me up on the phone, and she asked me would I come and visit her, you know, I mean. So I went to visit her, you know, because she was my first cousin. And my own wife was with her at that time. And on the way home, my wife was working for Dr. Moulton up here I don't know if you are acquainted with this place, Tully. There's a place over here, Undertaker on State Street, on this street, Tully the Undertaker. Well, the house next to it is Dr. Moulton's old original house. That's where my wife used to work, you know, for them. And they were a very nice couple, you know, she said, you know, they were very... very kind couple, always got along together, very good. But anyways, that's how my cousin asked me, would I leave her home? And that's how I happened to get acquainted with my wife, you know.
Uh-huh. And yeah. Then did you see her for a long time before you got married?
We were only going together about 6 months when we got married. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I was, you know, I was going on 30 years, so I decided my age, you know. All my friends, for example, I shummed around with, They were all married. Oh. The other Irish fellas that I shoved around with, they were all married. I decided I'd get married. So I never regret being getting married, you know.
What was it about your wife that?
Well, I know she was a very good girl. She was a very morally good girl. She was. Uh-huh. I that's one of the reasons I married her, dear. Uh-huh. So I you know, she was a And she, my poor wife, you know, I could, even for one of the kids, my daughter got married, they had a tough time putting it on. She never would use rouge or anything like that, but she allowed it to put it on the day of the wedding.
What yeah. was your wife's name?
Catherine.
And her maiden name?
Feeny. Uh-huh. But and no relation to, what's his name there? Oh, no, Feeny, I was going to say, what's his name in Boston there? Edward. Politician in Boston.
Oh.
It's not.
I don't know.
Yeah, and she was a Feeny, and she was she came here in 1924, and she was out here probably 24. She was here about 6 years when she got married.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then how many children did you have?
We had 10, dear. We had 10 children. Three of them died in infancy, though, and then seven of them lived. But my daughter, who was married, and she had 10 children, married French, Raymond Verino. They had 10, and she died in 86. My wife died in 75, and my Joe, the Peggy and Joe, they were twins, and Joe died about a year afterwards, you know, about 87. So there's two of them died, three, that, you know, plus the three babies, and so I got five living now, you know. Kevin, Jerry, he works down in the finance department at the city hall here, and Steve, the priest out here in Scarborough, and Vincent, who was here today from Boston, and Marianne, she's a nurse. I think she works maybe 2 days a week now in one of those convalescent homes. She's up in Connecticut. Her husband was working here, but he got transferred up to Connecticut. That's where they are now. She's up there, you know, for, oh, maybe 10 years since they moved up there.
And how many grandchildren do you have?
We have grandchildren, 24 grandchildren, and I have about 30 of great-grandchildren. Yeah.
My goodness.
Yes. Because my daughter, Mary, and Peggy, who got married, well, all her kids are married, and one of them has three, the other one has four, then the one has two, one has the other one has three, and Eileen, she's going to have the second baby, and I would say, I counted them, you know, I know she's got 18 or 19, you know, if she would have lived grandchildren, which are my great-grandchildren. Then in Boston, Packy, who was here today, or Vincent, he got six grandchildren, four daughters, they're married, six, and my Marianne in Connecticut, they have two, you know. So that's where, so I think I've got about 30 great-grandchildren. Yeah.
Thinking back over your life in Ireland and coming here, what are you proudest of? What makes you proud?
Well, I tell you the truth about it. I'm so happy. I'm happy that I came to this country, I'll tell you, because of the fact that I had opportunities to read and to broaden my mind and see different things, that if I would have stayed on the farm out there, I would be absolutely cut off from a lot of things that I got to know here. And you know, I would say America, I always liked it, because it's a great country, If anything's so wrong, the economy and all that, I think that one of the reasons for that today is greed that is killing the economy. They people, no matter how much they get, for example, you know, they are not satisfied. I think that's one of the basic causes of our trouble here, the economy. Because, for example, when my son died in 1987, because he was living with me, and the will was made out, we were going to leave him everything. So I had to go and change the will after he died. And I met this lawyer, a very, very popular lawyer here in Portland, Ralph Lancaster. He's a very, very, very outstanding, upright lawyer. And so I told him about it then. So he asked me about the price of my house, like. And I told him, you know, that I would say probably 75,000 if I sold it, 80,000, you know what I mean? It was Donald Grant Street, the smallest my family house. Well, you know, my granddaughter, who was in the real estate, she valued it at 95,000, but I wouldn't have the conscience to take that if anybody offered me. I didn't. But I sold it for $80,500, I guess. But I told Lancaster, unless the prices will come down. That's one thing that stayed in my mind. Oh, he said, no, he said, the prices won't come down. They will keep on going up. This is a year, a couple of years after that, everything fell crash, you know. So people with great brains, they could not foresee. People, you know, I mean, I'm like a donkey once said that they are intelligence. And I say they could not foresee what was going to happen here. And I say this is a beautiful country, but greed is ruining it. They, no matter how much they want more, see. Mm-hmm. And another thing about it, I believe in unions myself. I joined the union when I first here, but I know in many of them they abuse themselves. They abuse themselves. For example, while you're working for the one company here, and let's say I'm satisfied, the company's treating me right, and I'm getting all paid, but the union leader will say, well, they got a raise in this union over here, so we should go out for a strike too. Because not because we need it, but because let's keep going. They're getting ahead of us, something like that. That's the way I describe it. Mm-hmm. They abused it. One example I will use on that. When Reagan was president, let's say eight or nine years ago, maybe about that period, the controllers, air controllers out at the airport here now. The government offered them that time 30% raise, and they weren't satisfied. Their leader, their union leader, he said wanted $17,000 across the board raise. So Reagan, and I think he did a very good job. He gave them 40 years to get back and lose their job. A lot of them did lose their job, but they have nobody to blame but themselves, because my son in Boston. Who was a school teacher, graduated from a college, of course, and he was school teacher for 20 years. He said, to be an air controller, you don't have to have a college degree. If you have, all you need to have a high school diploma, and you go and take the examination, and if they think you are qualified and you're good judgment like that, you'll have to have a good judgment to be one of those air controllers. Yeah. And then if they hire you, they train you for 3 years, and during that 3 years, they're giving you enough money to get by on yourself. Well, now you figure out people that come from poor family. Let's say my kids, you know, we were brought, and in the name of goodness, why wouldn't they be satisfied? You know, I mean, why wouldn't they say, a lot of them could say, well, I'm way better off than my dad. Yeah, I mean, you know, luxury is the thing. So that's what I am against. Is abuse it. When people are treated right, if I was a young man today, for example, I'd rather go work for a company that wouldn't belong to no union at all, if I know they treat me right, you know. Because, you know, a lot of companies, you know, that they did out here, they were out here, Westbrook, for example, now, ST Warrens, they were very good to their workers all through the years. They bought a gymnasium, they made a gymnasium for Westbrook there. They have a hospital there. My own daughter worked there a while, hospital, and they supply all the heat to steam. And they don't cost them, they don't have to hire any firemen or anything. And you know, and then they want to join the union, and after they joined the union, they merged in with another company. Now, a lot of them, they lost a lot of their rights, you know, the company. But I would say, that's what I mean. I'm trying to describe it the best I can.
Yes,
I say unions have gone too far in too many cases. Mm-hmm. And they had no motive, no example, but greed. They said, well, this fellow's getting ahead of us. I mean, it's not the idea that that I'm making comfortable living. No, it's because the other fellow's making better than I am. Why should I worry about that?
Yeah. Let me ask you this. What is your old age like? How do you feel?
I'll tell you my old age. I enjoy my old age as good. And I deplore. I deplore when people of my age get depressed, like. They say lonely and all that stuff. I'm a reader, and I enjoy myself, you know. I am happy. I am as happy now in my old age as when I was 24 years old. I'll tell you a reason why, dear. Because in them days, when I was young and when I was married, I was worrying about a job, or I was worrying to get fired or something like that. I had something to worry about. I had to get up every morning and go to my work. I had responsibility. Now my responsibility is gone. I'm on my own. Nobody bothers me. I'm not responsible. My own kids take care of themselves. I don't have to worry about them. And I say I enjoy my old age as good as when I was young. Because, I mean, we have to go, you know, it's no use for me to say, oh, I wish I was young again, Pastor Yosef, go and try to go back. You know, you have to go. And I say, no, I'm not one bit, you know, I want, but some people I notice that down here, you know, they get lonely there by themselves. They got to have somebody to entertain them, but no, I'm not that at all. I'm very happy that I am, and I appreciate it here, because really, here in this place, nobody bothers you. Everybody has their own privacy here, too. Mm-hmm. Everybody yes. has their own privacy. You know, I got the same privacy here. I had a one-family house down on Grand Street, and of course, nobody bothered me except my own friends or anything would come to visit me. But I could say I got the same privacy here. I'm right. here for a little over 3 years now. Last 3 years ago, last March, I came here.
Uh-huh. Well, do you find that you think back over your life now that you have more time and you don't have to get up and go
well,
to work?
I heard an old man, an old farmer in my village back in Ireland one time. I said something like that question to Matthew. I said, if you had your life to live over again, what would you do? He said, I would live different. He said, I would live different. But in my own case, the way things worked out for me, I went through poverty and all depression and all that. But honest to goodness, I mean, when I look at it, at the depression and the hard life, but we were happy. I say, you know, with contentment, dear, it's very hard to lose it. If you're a millionaire and if you're not happy, what good is it? Money don't is not everything. You know, we have to have it, of course, but it's not the key to all our success. You know, to all our happiness in this world. You know, but I say, I wouldn't want. Maybe I'd be more cautious on things if I had my life to live over again, you know, but nobody gets that chance. No. Nobody gets that chance. But I said, I don't regret my experience. I don't regret, for example, I had my experience over in Ireland, but I never regretted coming here. I never regretted coming to this country. I mean, I always liked it here and freedom, you know what I mean? And a lot of people, you know, they have. It was a lot. America is a land of opportunities for any nationality. I don't care who they are. And I think if they fail sometime, they cannot blame the system here as their own fault, I will say, you know. A lot of them, you know, including my own, some of the Irish too, they abuse their opportunities themselves, you know. But if they didn't make a success of it, I think they had nobody to blame but themselves. But I say it's a beautiful country, and I'm glad that I came here, dear. I wouldn't want it any different. You know, somebody asked a few times would I like to go back and live in Ireland again? No, dear, I wouldn't. I like to go back and see the friends and the place and all that, but I wouldn't like to stay there, you know. I wouldn't. I'm so used to this place. I'm 70, 71 years ago since I came out here in South Portland. It's a long time ago, dear. 1921.
Wow. Well, maybe this is a good place to stop, and I'm very happy you came to this country, too.
Yeah.
And I'd like to thank you very much.
Thank you, dear. Yeah.
And this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I've been speaking with Stephen Kincannon in his home in Portland, Maine, and it's September 16th, 1992. Signing off.